Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we welcome author and farm historian Jerry Apps, a prolific writer who has published several novels, historic overviews of Wisconsin barns and breweries, and multiple volumes on his life in rural Washera County in the Depression and World War II, the subject of a PBS documentary, Jerry Apps, A Farm Story.
I am one who believes that where we grew up and when we grew up influences who we are today in ways that go way beyond, in many instances, our knowledge of that fact. How we see the world, how we see our relationship with other people, how we see the land and its importance, how we view nature, all of those, for those of us who grew up on farms at a time when I did, are a part of who we are today. And for a long time, I was not too pleased to share it because I was enamored by the quote-unquote more cosmopolitan people that I knew who had grown up in the city and knew the ways of the city. Today, I'm as proud can be, of having experienced what I experienced. I wouldn't change it for anything. Not that it was all wonderful, because it wasn't. We never made a whole lot of money. And all during the later years of the Depression, when I was a wee little one, things were tough. But we had work. Too much work, in my estimation, as a kid. But we had something to eat. And I always had a roof over my head and a pair of bib overhauls, new ones once a year or so. What more would you want? And friends and a chance to have some fun and to go fishing and to go for a walk. I mean, what more is there that's important?
Jerry Apps, A Farm Story, a PBS documentary that will be rebroadcast on Wisconsin Public Television this Sunday, March 3rd at 7 p.m. And we are pleased to be able to visit with Jerry for the next hour. He is joining us live in our Wisconsin Public Radio studio in Madison. I know a number of you have read Jerry's books and are familiar with the rural terrain of Wild Rose, Washera County, and the rest of central Wisconsin. Some of you may remember what it was like growing up on a farm without electricity in the Great Depression and the war years, or you may just have questions about that period of time. Either way, we'd like you to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Jerry, it's so good to be able to visit with you today.
I'm pleased to be here.
Your thoughts on that documentary, A Farm Story, what has the reaction to it been like?
The first reaction was one of surprise. I was just totally surprised that so many people were interested in what I consider to be rather humble stories of my growing up years. And as it turned out, many people have an interest in that, and that surprised me, and I'm still surprised by it. I'm also someone who does not especially like to watch. I don't like to watch myself on TV, and so I'm a little embarrassed. I've seen it several times, and so surprise and embarrassment, but it's also very humbling because all I tried to do with that documentary was to share some of my memories, share what I consider to be what it was like when I was a kid on the farm. And if that would be of interest to someone else, that would be wonderful. And beyond that, it was a surprise.
In that opening clip, you say that getting a new pair of bib overalls each year is really all you could ever want. Do you really mean that?
Well, I meant it then. I should add to it, though. I should have said then that a new pair of shoes also was a wonderful thing, because generally speaking, I would get a new pair of bib overalls and a new pair of shoes. And for whatever, those were important in those days. They really were. And I just loved a new pair of bib overalls because they had that wonderful new smell. And I was unhappy when they had to be washed for the first time. because some of that very special new smell of denim disappeared.
Yeah, you do a lot of speaking before young people around Wisconsin. How do they react when you say things like that?
Well, the first thing they react to is they can't imagine that someone would still be alive who experienced the things that I experienced. That's the first reaction. They look at me like I'm some sort of a historic artifact, which is okay. But a quick story. I sometimes bring along, when I speak to school kids, I bring along an old barn lantern, the kind that we used when I was a kid and when we milked cows by hand. And I show that to the kids, and I show them where we placed a match and how you lifted up the mantle, how you lifted up the globe, and all of that sort of stuff. And I'll never forget one day when I was doing that, and this little boy was sitting in the front row, paying particular attention. And I showed him the ladder, and I talked about that. And then I talked about lamps and how in the house we had lamps to light our way. And this little guy looked me right in the eye, and he said, "Mr. Apps," he said, "if you didn't have electricity, how did you watch television?" Well, there wasn't any television either, I had to point out to him, and he could not imagine a life without television.
Do you think young people have it too easy today, you know, compared to what it was like farming without electricity, without running water, cooking and heating your home with a wood stove, milking cows by hand, plowing behind a team of horses, and walking a mile and a half to attend school in a one-room building? It's a different life than most kids have today.
You'll find my answer surprising. In many ways, I think kids today have it tougher. Their challenges are greater. The expectations for them are terrific. It's a difficult time, I think, for young people these days to find their way. When I was growing up, it was clear, very clear, the direction that we should take. There was no ambiguity. We knew that we had to do our homework. We knew that we had to walk to school and to do the chores, and there wasn't any discussion about it. Not once would we even think to raise the question of, "I don't like to milk cows anymore. I don't think I want to do that." So the expectations were there, and there was no discussion ever about not doing what we were asked to do.
Well, it seems like today we not only have, ambiguous moral values, everyone is able to choose their own values, but people even seem to be able to choose their own facts. You know, we just seem to be adrift.
Well, I work mostly as a historian, and I have a tough time figuring out our history. And very often people want me, as you are right now, wanting me to comment on the present and what I think about the future. And I must say, I have trouble dealing with that because you are right. It's an ambiguous time. It's a difficult time. It's a challenging time. I'm muddling through myself. I can't imagine how younger people are dealing with the situation.
You know, that clash between old and new, between rural and urban, and between environmental stewardship and exploitation, also between the vanishing family farm and corporate agribusiness, these are themes that run through a lot of your work, including your fiction. Now, you've just published
My fiction.
You just published a book called Tamarack River Ghost. It's the fifth installment in I don't know if you call it this or your publisher calls it this, but the Ames County series of novels.
That's correct.
It involves an effort to locate a giant hog farm in a bucolic setting in Wisconsin. Tell us about that book.
Well, let me back up just a moment and mention that I created a county, a fictional county in Wisconsin that I call Ames.
Well, that's why I couldn't find it on the map.
People ask me, where in the world is Ames County? And I've had people come up to me with a map in hand, and Jerry, point out to me where Ames County is. My quick answer is, Ames County is the intersection of Wood County, Adams County, Marquette County, Washera County, Portage County, and maybe even a tad of Marathon County, and they look at me like I'm nuts. but it's in central Wisconsin. And what why I did that, and this frustrates people as well, I mix in real place names with fictional place names, and that baffles people. I do that on purpose. I also mix in real people with fictional characters, and that troubles some people. But back to Tamarack River Ghost and the whole series, I will pick out an issue, a concern that faces rural America, and I use Ames County, Wisconsin, as a focal point, as a place where we can examine an issue like large-scale farming from a variety of perspectives. And my main character in Tamarack River Ghost is a newspaper reporter, and he tries to be very objective about this. And he tries to dig, and does, I think, a fair job of digging out the facts, both pro and con, for large-scale agriculture, with the idea that people ultimately in a democratic society have to decide. They have to make up their own minds as to what direction they wish to go. But my hope through my writing is that that decision will be an informed decision, not merely a decision based on emotion or what somebody says we ought to believe. I am a firm believer in having everyone think for himself or herself and think about things in an informed way. Further, all my fiction books have a historical dimension to them, because I also believe that nearly every issue that we face today has a historical root. And in fact, we may have faced it previously, big versus small, food contamination, et cetera.
The whole concept of agribusiness, it's pulled right out of today's headlines. We've got a controversy right now in the town of Saratoga in Wood County, where they're trying to locate a large dairy farm. And, it speaks to what's happening right now, but you're right. Nothing comes out of a vacuum. Everything's got historical precedent.
That's right. And again, what I've been trying to do, and I can do it better with my fiction because I have my characters take different perspectives and debate with each other the merits of these perspectives. If I were to do that in my nonfiction work, it'd be more difficult. It would sound like I am taking a particular viewpoint. Here I'm really I suppose if you read it carefully, you can figure out what I believe. But I try to be as open-minded about these issues as I possibly can. And again, I spent many years as a teacher, mm-hmm. and I can't get that out of my system. I'm still teaching, and I get so upset when I see decisions made that are based almost entirely on emotion, with very little attention to fact, to detail, to history, to careful thinking. I'm disturbed by that.
Well, as a journalist, you have to look at both sides of an issue. You have to get into the skin of somebody else and understand why they feel and why they believe the way they do. And then you have to do the same thing with the people who disagree with them. So, I hear you. You know, the novel you wrote before that, The Travels of Increased Joseph, was also based in history. It involved a pioneer preacher based on apparently a real character from the 1800s.
No, he's not a real character, but the church is.
But it was based on that.
Yeah, the standalone church.
Right.
A very interesting piece of history. And again, to back up a bit, most people here in Wisconsin are well aware that many of our early settlers came to Wisconsin from upstate New York and other New England states. Many of them before the variety of European immigrants arrived. And these upstate New Yorkers, one of the things that I tried to do was to show what they were like when they came here to Wisconsin and how they got here. I researched the steamboat routes on the Great Lakes, for example, and how people left from Buffalo, New York, and made their way in the case of Increase Joseph Link to Sheboygan. Sheboygan had a really fine harbor. Sheboygan and Milwaukee had the two really good harbors in the middle 1800s. And then I trace how this preacher who was thrown out of the Harvard Divinity School because his thoughts were too progressive, how he made his way to Wisconsin and brought with him a group of followers, the standalones, they called themselves, the standalone religion. Interestingly enough, there was a standalone church in upstate New York, and this is where it's uncanny, in Rose, New York, which is the town after which Wild Rose was named.
Wow.
And that same standalone church was organized in Wild Rose. So that's how I mix reality with fiction. There was such a church. I can show you exactly where it stood. And I can show you where the cemetery is. It's on Highway 22, just south of Wild Rose a bit.
But what do you enjoy more, writing fiction or nonfiction?
Both. I love doing research. I do as much research for my nonfiction as I do for my fiction. But I've been writing nonfiction for more than 40 years, and every so often I get bogged down with my nonfiction, and fiction for me is a far more difficult thing to do. It's such a wonderful challenge to try and craft a story that is not only enjoyable and fun to read, but has, causes someone to think about something in a way where they may have not previously thought. That's one of the reasons I like doing fiction. This will sound strange. I teach creative writing. You probably know that. I've done that for 40-some years. And I tell my writing students to not do what I do because I'm generally writing at least two books at the same time.
Uh-huh.
One is fiction and one is nonfiction. And I move back and forth. When I get hung up on my fiction, and that's often, I switch to nonfiction. And I go back and forth all the time. And I've done that for years.
Well, growing up on that rural farm near Wild Rose, did you ever think that all of those boring, mundane childhood experiences would become the stuff of a successful literary career and a PBS documentary?
Boy, did I am just unbelievably surprised by that. Because when I first started writing about my growing up years, I was mostly doing it for my family and maybe a few neighbors who had the same experience. And I had no idea that anybody beyond that would care a whit about what I experienced. Was I wrong? I was so wrong about that.
You grew up, of course, you know, with an appreciation for country life because you lived it, and for the simple pleasures of being outdoors. Did you and your wife have to work at imparting that same appreciation to your own kids who grew up, I assume, in a different kind of environment?
Well, my kids grew up in Madison. They're city kids. However,
yeah, I understand your daughter is sitting in with you.
Yeah, right she's now. Sitting right next to me, so she's smirking right now. she's an elementary teacher here in Madison. But in 1966, we acquired a farm 2 miles from the farm where I grew up, and we have been running that farm ever since. I run it as a tree farm, and so the kids grew up with the farm. And they, we all spend a lot of time there still. I spend a lot of time there, and my son Steve lives here in Madison too. Steve is the chief photographer for the Wisconsin State Journal, and he does the pictures for all my books.
And your daughter is a budding author, according to what you were telling me.
Yeah, Susie has a new book coming out September, August, this fall anyway. It's a book for young readers, elementary age readers, on one room schools, and she interviewed her father for the book.
Good person to interview. Well, Jerry, we're going to talk about that one-room school and the other things that are in that PBS documentary, Jerry Apps, A Farm Story. And if you just joined us, it will be shown again on Wisconsin Public Television this Sunday, March 3rd at 7 p.m. Jerry Apps is with us for the next hour, and we'd like you to join us, too, if you have any questions or observations. 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. The voice was chanting as the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me.
Support for WPR comes from Rely Local Wausau, building the local economy and strengthening the community by making local business everybody's business. More about locally owned and operated businesses at relylocal.com.
And our forecast for north central Wisconsin: becoming partly cloudy tonight, a low of 15. Friday, partly sunny, a high of 30. Turning colder at night with a low of 5 above zero. Saturday, mostly sunny, a high of 28, a low of 5 above. Sunday, mostly sunny, a high of 28, and a low of 10 above. Right now, we've got cloudy skies with a few flurries to the north, partly cloudy to the south, 23 degrees in Land O'Lakes, 25 in Woodruff and Eagle River, 26 in Antigo, 27 in Phillips and Tomahawk, 28 in Medford, Marshfield, and Stevens Point, 32 in Wapaka, 30 in Merrill, and 29 degrees outside our studio in Wausau. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Our guest, Jerry Apps, the subject of a PBS documentary, which will be rebroadcast this Sunday, March 3rd at 7 p.m. And, Jerry, with your permission, I'm going to play a short clip from that documentary, which you're talking about milking the cows with your dad.
I'm the oldest, so I'm expected to be out in the barn by 5:30 in the morning helping with the milking. We had two barn lanterns. My dad had one, I had one. I hang my barn lantern on the nail in back of the cows on the north end of the barn. South end of the barn, my dad hangs his lantern on the nail, and the cows are all lined up. There's about 14, 16 of them, all standing in stanchions. And I have my cows to milk, and he has his cows to milk. And the barn on a winter day is the warmest place on the farm. And underneath the big old Holstein cow, it's by far the most comfortable place you could find, as strange as that sounds. And so I would crawl under this cow, put the milk pail between my knees, sit on a three-legged stool, and grab the spigots and start milking. And a cat comes by and you squirt a little milk in the direction of the cat. And I'm tucked under this big old Holstein, and she's looking around at me, and she's saying, "Good morning, Jerry," and I'm kind of asleep, and I'm all just getting warm. And we got to know every one of them. And our farm dog knew their personalities better than I did, because she dealt with each cow in a very particular way, and even in a mysterious kind of way. There's a communication between animal species that we don't understand, and that was going on with Fanny talking to these cattle, and they had great respect for her.
You know, Jerry, after reading your books, I feel that I know a lot of the farm animals that you grew up with. Fanny the dog, Ginger the pony. Really, you know, quite an evocative image of being side by side with your dad like that, doing all of those household chores. There must have been a closeness to your family.
That's one of the things that I talk about when I speak to groups, that not that it's not like that today in the rural communities, because I think in many ways it is. But the family was very important. The family was very close, and they had to be, because in many ways we were our own little community, a part of a larger community of neighbors. And that interrelationship among the members of the family was extremely important. We depended on each other to make things work, as we depended on our neighbors both in times of need and to do those jobs that required more than the family, such as threshing and silo filling and that sort of thing. But back to the relationship with my dad, my father and my mother, neither of them graduated from eighth grade, and people cannot believe that was the case. My dad had a fifth grade education, and yet he was one of the smartest guys I ever knew. My mother had a seventh grade education. In their generation, in central Wisconsin, when they were growing up, the idea of schooling was related to work. And when you were big enough to work, then my grandparents pulled them out of school and they went to work. It's something that's very hard for people today to understand. And let me add this too. It wasn't because my parents were opposed to formal education, not in any way. In fact, it was just the opposite. They were bound determined that I have two brothers, twin brothers, that the three of us would be well educated. Two of us have PhD degrees, so they succeeded. They did not understand what it was like to go to high school. They had no conception whatever of what undergraduate work was in college. And to talk about a PhD degree, that was unbelievable. They couldn't imagine what that was. In fact, a quick story. When I got my PhD degree, my mother was at this reception with my major professor. And my major professor said to my mother, "You must be proud of your son. He has a doctor's degree." And my mother said, "He's no doctor. He can't even cure a chicken."
You know, let's talk about your twin brothers and your mother for just a second. In one of your books, When Chores Were Done, Boyhood Stories, you got a chapter labeled Winter Delivery about the birth of those twin brothers. And it must have made a real impression on you because you remember it clearly and you were only 4 years old at the time.
That's right. It was the 31st day of January, and it was probably, I don't know, 20 below zero, 25 below zero, fierce blizzard had blown through Washer County, plugging up all of the roads. There was no possible way for a doctor to get to the house. And in those days, we weren't going to the hospital anyway. We were all born at home. Nobody went to the hospital. The nearest hospital would have been, I suppose, Stevens Point or Oshkosh. And what happened, which I you're right, I can remember it as if it were yesterday. The story went like this. When my mother was ready to deliver, my dad hitched up the team to the bobsled and drove through the fields down to the intersection of the county road with our country road, and there met the doctor because the county road had been plowed. And this country doctor climbed onto the bobsled, and they rumbled across the fields, stopped at the neighbor's on the way to pick up the midwife, Mrs. Miller, and proceeded to our farmhouse. And my memory was when I got up in the morning and came downstairs, and there on the dining room table were these two very pink, reddish young babies kicking away, and I couldn't believe where had they come from. I couldn't believe what in the world were we doing. And the wood stove in the dining room was a cherry red because it was so cold, and of course they wanted to keep these little guys warm. So I've never forgotten that. And I remind my brothers of that every so often, they kind of roll their eyes.
Your house was a maternity ward that day, but then it was also a funeral parlor. In Living a Country Year, you tell the story about the death of your grandpa Whit and how they kept his body in a bedroom in your home for a week.
That was very common in those days. The memories of that are also embedded in my mind and in a strange way. Of course, I can remember walking past the casket to bed every night. But what I remember most is the smell of the flowers. And when I smell flowers, funeral flowers, I suspect you could call them, I am immediately tossed back to the time when my grandfather was in the in a casket in our living room.
So you've got this. Go on, Jerry. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's some people think that sounds sort of strange and maybe even a little weird. It was not. It was very common. Everybody did that.
You got this circle of life, and it's all being done in your country farmhouse. Kids born, people growing up, people working, old people dying and lying in rest, all taking place at home.
That's right. And I, more recently, I've begun writing more about the importance of the farm home and how it was the center of all activity on the farm. And it is where the decisions were made. It is where the baby chicks were warmed up back of the stove. It's where the baby pigs that were born too early in the spring were brought in and put behind the stove. It is where we did our homework. It is where we cut up a pig that we butchered on the kitchen table. I mean, everything that was a part of family life took place in that old farmhouse.
Jerry Apps, author, farm historian, and the subject of a PBS documentary, Jerry Apps, A Farm Story, that will be rebroadcast this coming Sunday at 7 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Television. 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742. We'll be back after this. Well, our guest today on Route 51, Jerry Apps, is a periodic guest on Larry Mueller's show. Jerry, have you started your garden seeds yet? I know you're not supposed to start until, St. Patrick's Day?
17th of March. You can start them too early. I have some friends that are already starting their seeds. Unless you have grow lights and have a fancy system, if it's too early.
They end up, I do that. I start my seeds.
They're too spindly.
Ahead of time.
They get
spindly. And, what you end up doing is buying them from a greenhouse if you start them too early. I've got a quote from you here somewhere. I've got all these quotes from your books. And here are some horticulture quotes. You can count the number of seeds in an apple, but the number of apples in a seed will remain forever a mystery. I love that.
That's pretty good. I wish I'd come up with that. I stole that from somewhere.
Stop to look at a wild daisy, you write. Daisies stand straight and tall, their yellow centers and delicate white petals adding a splash of color to their surroundings. Daisies are eaten, trod upon, sliced off, and beaten back, but they always return tall and sturdy and in full color. No complaints, no excuses.
Yeah, that's one of mine. There are a lot of things in nature like that we can relate to what we as human beings do, and the daisy is one of them.
And here's another one. On a cold afternoon, page through a new seed catalog that has arrived in the mail. This is something I do. It's an early reminder of summer, and its colorful pictures evoke both memories and promises.
Lots of promises in those colored pictures.
Let's play another clip from that PBS documentary, Jerry Apps, A Farm Story. Here you're talking about some of the kids you grew up with.
Our nearest neighbor was a half a mile away, and that was considered a close neighbor. The other direction, there was another one maybe three-quarters of a mile away, and our good friends, the Kolka boys, they were a mile away, a little more than that by the road. We could go across the fields. It was a mile. By the way, we thought nothing of walking from farm to farm, and we would walk to Chain Lake to ice skate in the winter, which was a mile and a half, and when we would get there, we'd build a big bonfire. Oh, the nights in the fall and the winter were so dark. The blessing of that is when we'd be walking to a neighbor on a clear night in January, when it's maybe zero and the snow crunched underfoot, the whole sky was ablaze with stars. You could see stars everywhere and in every direction. It was a magnificent time. We would ice skate at night. We would ski at night. I don't remember ever having any problem seeing. And we didn't have such thing as a flashlight. And we never used lamps or lanterns when we walked anywhere. And yet we seemed to be able to see where we were going.
Yeah, Jerry, who gave him the right to take our night sky away from us? That's my question.
Yeah, we've done a number on that, haven't we? One of the wonderful things about my farm in Washoe County is there's essentially no light pollution. And on a clear night, especially in winter, I again can look at stars from horizon to horizon, and it's a wonderful thing. And I'm afraid that we have a couple of generations of people who probably have never, ever taken the time to look up and see what's there. Maybe they've seen pictures in a book, or maybe they've seen something on television. But to see it naturally, to see it standing out there all by yourself, the stillness of the night, and looking upward. And it gives one a feeling of how tiny, how small, how little we are as human beings in this great universe of which we are a part. It sounds a little corny.
Well, but it isn't corny. It's better than being in church, you know, in terms of putting you in touch with what's eternal. Jerry, one of the books you wrote a few years back that I really enjoyed was called Living a Country Year, and there are 12 chapters in that book, one for each month, in which you share stories from your childhood tied to the changing seasons. You talk about that ice skating story in there. And one of the stories from May of 1947 that took me by surprise when I read it, I didn't know you came down with polio.
I'm glad you raised that question, because I have a new book coming out in April that's called Limping Through Life, and it's a story of my polio years. My editor at the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, and they do all of my history, nearly all of my history books. UW Press does my fiction. But my editor at the Historical Society Press said to me one day, she said, "Jerry, when are you going to write a book about your polio experience? You've written little snippets about it." That was one of the most difficult books I've written. It was something that changed my life forever. It started, I came down with polio in winter of in January 1947, and my right leg was paralyzed for a good part of a year. And now as I think about it, it allowed me to not do many things. I could not play basketball, baseball, or anything like that. But, you know, I was thinking about it today, because I have the early copy of the book now. The good Lord did a number on me when polio came around. But on the other hand, the good Lord said, "Apps, I'll give you a voice, and I'll give you a brain that will allow you to write." And isn't it interesting how things work out?
You spent a lot of time. Obviously, you couldn't go. I hear you're 12 years old, right? 12 years old.
That's correct.
You're looking forward to going to high school, and you'd learned how to ice skate. You're a very active young man. Your dad is depending on you being active in the farm and helping him out, and you're faced with the possibility of never being able to walk in your life for the rest
of your
life.
That's exactly right. Yeah. In fact, that was the prediction from the doctor who said to me, when I was, as you might guess, feeling very sorry for myself, and I said it looks like I'm not going to be able to walk again. And he said, "That's right." And then he said something I'd never forgotten. He said, "But you're still alive. because in those days, lots of kids died with polio. It was a terrible disease.
There was a kid in your neighborhood who died from polio, correct?
Exactly. The neighbor kid died. A terrible disease.
And young people...
1955, I mentioned the Salk vaccine came around in 55. And no one... I don't do this very often. No one should avoid being vaccinated for polio. It's just a terrible disease.
And the Rotary clubs, I'm a member of Rotary. It's one of our big goals to eliminate polio all throughout the world. And in some parts of the world, there is that fear, that mistrust of vaccines. And
that's right.
It's something we've got to
overcome. Some of the African countries.
How did your dad react when you came down with polio?
Well, I in this polio limping through life book, I described that reaction, and I'll paraphrase. I don't remember exactly what I wrote, but when the doctor said to my dad, when my dad asked what's wrong with Gerald, he always called me Gerald in those days. The doctor said he has polio, and my dad had the most sorrowful look on his face, and the way I described it, he had the look on his face that was the same look he had when one of his best cows died. When a best cow died, it was a terrible situation.
But he made you go out and drive the tractor, right?
He did, and I was so angry with him. I've got a chapter in this book about my therapy. There were no physical therapists that I was aware of in Washer County.
But it sounds like your dad was playing the role of one, because anyone who's gone in for major surgery will say the same thing about physical, call them physical terrorists, you know.
He was so disgusted with me, and I, from my perspective, that I was moping around the house and I couldn't walk and I was losing weight and I was a miserable, mean kid. Nobody, my brothers avoided me. It was a terrible time. And it was April of 47. And the crops had to be put in. And the corn ground needed to be disked. And my dad set me on our old Farmall H tractor. And he said, well, your arms work, don't they? And I said, well, yeah. And my left leg works, that's true. If those who know about driving a Farmall H tractor know that the clutch is on the left side and the brake is on the right side, and the front wheels on the Farmall H were together. It was a tricycle kind of model. They were close together. And in order to turn, you not only had to turn the steering wheel, but you had to put your foot on the brake in the direction in which you wish to turn. And my right leg didn't work. And I tore down a wire fence when the tractor wouldn't turn with the disc. And I thought my father would be furious with me. He was not. I think he halfway expected that was going to happen. He just got on the tractor, turned it around, sat me back on it again and said, go ahead. I was so angry with him, I was ready to go back to the house. He said, you're not going back to the house. Get back on the tractor. And after a couple of weeks, my leg began to work again.
Jerry, do you think your bout with polio helped turn you into the person you are today, the writer,
the reader? Absolutely. Because one of the first things that happened, I couldn't play any sports, of course, in high school, and I started high school in that fall. But the coach, his name was Paul Wright in Wild Rose High School, was the most wonderful man, as I think back. I've dedicated a whole chapter to Paul Wright. And In those days, the high school coaches coached everything. He coached basketball, and he coached baseball and track, and he also was in charge of forensics, public speaking, and he taught several courses. He did everything. He managed the school play. And he said to me one day, he said, he knew I was feeling pretty sorry for myself. He said, "Jerry, we need somebody." I don't think he really did. This was true, but he said to me anyway. He said, "Jerry, we need somebody to announce the basketball games." And that was my first introduction to a microphone. I'm, what, 13 years old, and I've got a microphone in my hand. And I am announcing the basketball games.
And suddenly
Two
you're...
2 points, Alan Walters.
Suddenly
and
you're...
On and on.
Suddenly you're a star just like the players out in the field. I want to play...
Yeah.
I want to play one more clip. We're running short of time
Go
here.
Ahead.
And
yes.
As they say, all things must change, and that also happened to your rural life in Washera County.
The people in the village in Wild Rose, they all had electricity. That went way back to the days when the mill generated electricity for the village. But none of our neighbors had electricity until after the war. Everybody had lamps and lanterns. Lamps in the house, lanterns outside. Now, go back to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and part of his New Deal was to sign legislation that created the Rural Electrification Administration, the REA. And they began stringing lines to farmers. Well, World War II came along in 1941, and all of that stopped because there weren't any men available, copper wire wasn't available. After the war, REA was now coming into the communities. The farmers were responsible for wiring their buildings prior to the electric company, the language of the day, hooking us up to the main line. And so we hired a couple of electricians, and they wired the house, and they wired the barn, and they wired the milk house, and they wired the chicken house, and they wired all of the buildings. Took them several weeks. They wired everything except the outhouse. My dad said, whatever goes on in there does not require extra light.
Everything but the outhouse. How did electricity change rural life?
It was one of the most important things that happened. Of all of the technological advances, and I've lived through a bunch of them, that, for me personally, was far and away the most profound. And it went way beyond the obvious. It went way beyond the fact that now we could have motors to run our equipment, and we could light our way with the flip of a switch. The part that people often didn't understand was the sociological dimensions of what was going on. Because now, for the first time, farm people and city people had a more common experience. And as you mentioned earlier, there was clearly a division for years between country people and city people. And one of the reasons for the division was electricity. Because Wild Rose, for example, which was a metropolis of 600 people when I was a kid, they had electricity as early as 1908. We did not have electricity till 1947. Look at that. All of those years of discrepancy. So electricity was, and I've done many things. I've traveled all over the world. But for me, when electricity came to our farm, that was one of the most important things that happened, because now I could invite my friends from the village to come out to the farm, and I wouldn't have to be ashamed because we were sitting around the table with a kerosene lamp lighting our way.
You know, in one of your first books, The Land Still Lives, it was published back in 1970. There was a foreword by Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson, who helped start the first Earth Day that very year. I read that foreword, and this is what he says. "Today, the crisis of the environment is the biggest challenge facing mankind. To meet it will call for reshaping our values, to put quality on a par with quantity as a goal of American life. It will require sweeping changes in our institutions, national standards for the goods we produce, a humanizing of our technology, and close attention to the problem of our expanding population. Most of all, it will require that the people assert their right to a decent environment and they evolve an ecological ethic of understanding and respect for the bonds between man and his planet. That was 43 years ago, Jerry. What happened?
And he nailed it then, and that those comments are as applicable today as they were then.
Jerry Apps, thanks so much for being with us today. We really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I enjoy doing it.
And again, that documentary, Jerry Apps, A Farm Story, if you haven't seen it, it's this coming Sunday, March 3rd at 7 p.m. on Wisconsin Public Television.
The sun beating down turned the red paint to orange, and rusty old patches of steel. There's no farmer songs on that car radio, just cowboys, truck drivers, and pain. Well, this is my way to say thanks for the meal, and I hope there's no shortage of rain. Straw hat and old dirty hankies, mopping a face like a shoe. Thanks for the meal, here's a song that is real, from a kid from the city to you. Straw hat and old dirty hankies, mopping a face like a shoe. Thanks for the meal, here's a song that is real, from a kid from the city to you.
And we want to thank today's guest, author and farm historian Jerry Apps. His latest book is a novel, Tamarack River Ghost, published by Terrace Books of Madison. You can find out more about Jerry and his work at jerryapps.com. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Special music today by Woody Guthrie, Montgomery Gentry, and Murray McLaughlin. Next week on Route 51, we dip into the central Wisconsin blues music scene as we preview the All-Day Blues Cafe Festival in Wausau. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. And until next week, we are heading out of town.